Usually, when you pick up a classic 19th century novel, you have this very specific expectation of the setting,
Oh,
right?
yeah, absolutely. You're expecting like a very controlled environment.
Right. You picture a quiet drawing room somewhere, people sitting around in tight corsets, drinking tea.
Agonizing over some misunderstanding about an inheritance, maybe.
Exactly. Or taking a really dramatic windswept walk across a moor.
Yeah, the conflicts are usually driven by this very rigid, specific set of social manners. Etiquette is everything.
But then, you open up Herman Melville's Moby Dick, and that polite little drawing room is just violently smashed to pieces.
Oh, completely obliterated.
You are thrown into a totally different universe. I mean, suddenly you find yourself on a wooden ship that literally smells like blood and boiling fat.
Yeah, it's visceral.
And you are surrounded by this crew of outcasts from all over the globe, and they are hunting literal sea monsters.
Right, and led by a captain who is actively shaking his fist at the heavens, just trying to fight whatever god is up there.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what we are exploring on today's deep dive into the source material. This is our Book Candy Companion Conversation, created for Clara and Horatio.
Yeah, we are unpacking the mechanics of madness, industry, and survival inside this legendary book.
Because it really is the ultimate literary shock to the system.
It really is. I mean, if you approach this text thinking it's simply a nautical adventure,
Like a fishing trip gone wrong.
yeah, exactly. If you think it's just a fishing trip, the sheer scale of what Melville is attempting will completely blindside you.
Oh, for sure.
Because it's not just a story. It's a manual on global industry. It's a philosophical fever dream. And honestly, it's a psychological thriller.
It totally is. And to give you, the listener, a way to visualize the setting before we even get into the plot, I actually found a specific analogy really helpful when I was going through our sources.
Oh, what kind of analogy?
Well, I like to think of the ship in this book, the Pequod, as a 19th century space station.
Okay, wait, I like that. Tell me how you're mapping that out.
Well, think about the mechanics of the situation, right? You have this claustrophobic, highly technical vessel, and it's launched into the absolute unknown.
The deepest, most remote parts of the Pacific Ocean.
Right. And to people in the 1850s, the middle of the Pacific might as well have been deep space.
Oh, absolutely.
The environment outside the ship is completely hostile to human life. I mean, if you fall overboard, you die.
Yeah, there's no backup.
And this vessel is crewed by this isolated band of strangers who speak different languages, all crammed together in a tiny wooden tube.
Right.
And their mission, I mean, they are hunting for the literal fuel of their civilization. They're essentially doing deep space resource mining.
Just to harvest the oil that keeps the lights on back home. That's a
That's.
perfect way to look at it because the isolation and that intense industrial pressure, it's the perfect pressure cooker for what happens
Yeah,
next.
it really sets the stage.
Melville forces us to look at this floating factory and see the existential terror that's humming beneath the floorboards. He demands that we look beyond the surface level of the physical world.
Right, which brings up that crucial concept introduced later by Captain Ahab.
Yes, the pasteboard masks.
I have that flagged in my notes.
Yeah.
He basically claims that all visible objects are just pasteboard masks. Like he thinks the physical world is just a mask covering up something else.
Exactly. Ahab believes that behind the mask of the physical universe, and specifically, behind the mask of one giant white whale, there is a cosmic, reasoning, and malicious machinery at work.
Malicious being the key word there.
Right. And our goal today is to help you see that machinery. We want to dismantle the pasteboard mask of this famous story.
I am so ready for that. But before we get into Ahab's psychology, I feel like we need to understand the reality of the world he's operating in.
The whaling industry itself.
Yeah, because when I first thought of whaling before reading this, I pictured a really small-scale operation, a few guys in a little boat.
A local fisherman vibe.
Right. But the source material makes it incredibly clear that whaling in the 1800s was this massive, highly organized machine.
Oh, it was the equivalent of the modern petroleum industry. I mean, it literally was the energy sector.
Wow.
Whale oil was the premium fuel of the Industrial Revolution. It lubricated the machines in the factories, and it burned incredibly bright and clean in the lamps of homes and streets.
Oh, without it.
Without it, the industrial expansion of the 19th century basically grinds to a halt. Melville actually spells this out in a chapter called The Advocate. where the narrator, Ishmael, defends his profession.
Yeah, Ishmael gets remarkably defensive in that chapter.
He really does.
He knows people on land look down on whalers. They see them as just, you know, dirty butchers who smell like fish.
Right, he anticipates that exact judgment. He points out that if you were to introduce a man in polite society as a harpooner, people would scoff.
They'd be horrified.
But then he hits the reader with the economic and historical reality. He argues that whalemen were the true pioneers of the globe.
Because they outnumber all other navies.
Exactly. While military ships were fighting over known borders, the whaling ships were out there charting the unknown Pacific, discovering islands.
Creating the actual maps that merchants and navies would use later.
Yes.
I noticed this one line where Ishmael basically claims that every lamp burning around the globe is burning as a shrine to the glory of the whalers.
Which is such a flex.
It really is.
Yeah.
It was a global enterprise bringing in millions of dollars a year. And the epicenter of this massive capitalist machine was the island of Nantucket in Massachusetts.
Right.
Which brings up a historical detail that totally threw me off when I was going through the text. Nantucket was settled by Quakers.
Yes. The Society of Friends.
The Quakers are famously pacifists, right?
Very strict pacifists.
They refuse to bear arms. They refuse to participate in war. They advocate for peace. So, and some that I don't get, how do you have a society of strict, pious pacifists running those violently blood-soaked, ruthless industry on the planet?
It is a staggering contradiction, and Melville zeroes right in on it. He introduces us to the two principal owners of the Pequod, Captain Peleg and Captain Bildad.
Right, the retired whalemen.
Yeah, they retired from the sea and now they finance the voyages. And Bildad is presented as this severe scripture-reading Quaker who just sits around in his plain coat reading his Bible.
Okay.
Yet, as Melville points out, this man who opposes the shedding of human blood has spent his entire life wading through the literal gore of slaughtered animals to amass a massive fortune.
The cognitive dissonance is just wild.
It's incredible. Ishmael actually wonders how Bildad reconciles his peaceful religion with his incredibly violent career.
Now, what's the conclusion?
The conclusion is essentially that Bildad completely separates his religion from his wallet. The text says something to the effect of his religion is one thing, but this practical world pays dividends.
Wow. Just the hypocrisy of capitalism masking itself with piety.
Exactly. And that tension between the spiritual and the brutally physical, it runs through the entire narrative. Melville wants you to feel the weight of this subject immediately.
Yeah, he doesn't even ease you into it. He doesn't even start the book with chapter one.
No, he doesn't.
He starts with a section simply called extracts. And this part was baffling at first glance.
It confuses a lot of people.
Right, because before the story even begins, there are pages and pages of random quotes about whales compiled by this fictional character called a sub-librarian. Like, why start a novel with a bibliography?
Well, it serves a very specific psychological purpose. This sub-librarian has supposedly burrowed through all the libraries of the world to find, like, every single mention of a whale in human history.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. He pulls quotes from the book of Genesis,
no.
From the book of Job, you know, asking if you can draw out Leviathan with a hook.
He quotes Shakespeare, Milton.
Historical accounts, obscure Nantucket work songs, all of it.
It feels overwhelming to read. You just get hit with the entire history of human literature before you even meet the main character.
And that's exactly the point. Melville is making an argument before the plot even starts. By front-loading the book with centuries of writing, he is proving that the whale is not just a biological animal, you know.
Or just a source of oil.
Right. It is a creature that has haunted the human imagination since the dawn of time. He is preparing you for a story of mythic biblical proportions.
Okay, that reframes it perfectly. So we have this massive, mythic, highly organized capitalist industry. But that brings me to a huge question about our narrator, Ishmael.
Okay, let's talk about Ishmael.
In that famous opening chapter, Loomings, Ishmael explains why he decides to join a whaling ship. And he doesn't say he wants to get rich.
No, not at all.
He says he goes to sea as a substitute for pistol and ball. Like, he is joining the bloodiest industry on earth to cure his severe depression.
Call me Ishmael. I mean, it's a legendary opening. He confesses that whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul.
Such a great line.
It's beautiful. Whenever he finds himself pausing before coffin warehouses or getting so angry he wants to just knock people's hats off in the street, he takes to the ship. It is his alternative to taking his own life.
But I struggled to make sense of that logic. If you are deeply depressed and you want to feel better, why not just, I don't know, take a passenger ship? Or join a standard merchant vessel sailing to Europe.
Right, something a bit safer.
Yeah. Why sign up for years of hard labor, isolation, and immense physical danger?
Because a merchant ship is just moving cargo from one society to another, and Ishmael doesn't want society. Society is what is causing the damp, drizzly November in his soul.
Oh, I see.
He says he is tormented with an everlasting itch for things remote. He wants to sail forbidden seas. When the existential dread of civilization creeps in, he seeks out the raw, terrifying power of the ultimate wilderness.
He specifically mentions being drawn by the idea of the great whale itself, doesn't he?
Yes, this grand hooded phantom. He is looking for an encounter with the sublime.
He basically needs to feel small in the face of something massive and ancient to snap him out of his own head.
That's exactly it.
That actually makes a lot of sense. So with Ishmael seeking this extreme escape, let's trace his actual journey. Let's map out the trajectory of the Pequod so you listeners know the structure of the voyage.
Let's walk through it. And just keep in mind, we are going to cover the entire plot here, right down to the bottom of the ocean.
Spoiler alert.
Heavy spoiler alert.
So the story kicks off with Ishmael leaving New York and heading for Nantucket. But he misses the ferry and gets stuck in the port town of New Bedford for the weekend.
Right. And he needs a cheap place to stay.
Exactly. So he goes to the Spouter Inn. And the landlord tells him the place is completely booked and the only way he can get a bed is if he agrees to share it with a harpooner.
A harpooner who is currently out selling shrunken heads.
Which is just a wild detail to drop on a guest. It is a remarkably tense, comedic setup. Ishmael is this relatively educated, prejudiced guy from the city. And he is terrified of this unknown savage.
And the execution of the scene is brilliant.
He gets into the bed. He's trying to sleep. And in the middle of the night, this massive, heavily tattooed Polynesian man named Queequeg walks into the room.
And Queequeg has no idea Ishmael is in his bed.
None. He pulls out a tomahawk, which also functions as a pipe, lights it up, and just starts worshiping a little wooden idol named Yojo right there in the room.
And Ishmael's basically having a panic attack.
He starts screaming for the landlord. Queequeg is ready to attack this stranger in his bed, but the landlord comes in and calms them down. And the crazy twist is they end up becoming incredibly close friends almost overnight.
They bond over a shared sense of being outsiders, really. They share the bed, they share Queequeg's money, and they decide to travel to Nantucket together to sign onto a ship.
Queequeg even lets his little wooden idol, Yojo, magically dictate which ship they should choose.
Which is how they end up on the Pequod. And even the description of the ship is unsettling.
Oh, very.
It is decorated with the huge teeth and bones of whales. It looks like a cannibalistic vessel.
So they meet Peleg and Bildad to sign the employment papers, but the actual captain of the ship is mysteriously absent.
Captain Ahab remains hidden for a while, but the rumors about him build the anticipation. Peleg describes Ahab as a grand, ungodly, godlike man.
And he casually mentions that Ahab lost his leg to a whale on his previous voyage.
Just a minor detail, right?
Yeah.
And before they leave the dock, this ragged man named Elijah approaches Ishmael and Queequeg. He warns them that signing on to Ahab's ship means signing their souls away.
But they just brush it off as the ramblings of a madman.
Naturally.
So they set sail on a freezing, ominous Christmas day. And for the first few weeks, the ship is run entirely by the three mates, Starbuck, Stubb, and Flask. Ahab stays locked in his cabin.
Building that suspense.
But then we hit the inciting incident. Ahab finally comes up to the deck.
His physical appearance is just striking. He has a stark white lightning scar running down his face and neck like a man cut away from a steak.
And he is standing on an artificial leg.
Yes. Made entirely from the polished jawbone of a sperm whale.
He is literally standing on the bones of his enemy.
It's an incredible visual. He gathers the entire crew together for what is known as the quarterdeck scene. He pulls out a Spanish gold coin, a doubloon, and nails it to the mainmast.
And he announces that the gold coin will go to the first man who spots a very specific whale.
A white-headed whale with a wrinkled brow and a crooked jaw.
And the harpooners immediately recognize the description. Tashtego, the Native American harpooner, asks if that white whale is the one some men call Moby Dick.
And that is when the trap springs shut. Ahab loses his composure entirely. He yells that it was Moby Dick that dismasted him and brought him to the dead stump he stands on.
And then he forces the crew into this frenzied oath.
Yeah, he makes the harpooners drink liquor from the metal sockets of their weapons. He makes them swear to hunt Moby Dick across all the oceans until he rolls Finn out.
He completely hijacks the voyage. This isn't a commercial oil-gathering mission anymore. It is a suicide mission of pure
Yeah,
vengeance.
and the first mate, Starbuck, is the only one who tries to apply the brakes.
Starbuck is basically the voice of reason and commerce here.
Exactly. He points out the absurdity of the situation. He tells Ahab, "Look, I came to hunt whales for profit, not for my commander's vengeance."
He actually calls it madness and blasphemy to seek revenge on a dumb brute that only struck Ahab out of blind biological instinct.
But Ahab just crushes Starbuck's resistance through sheer charismatic force and philosophical intimidation.
So from there, the global chase is on. The Pequod sails down through the Atlantic, rounds the Cape of Good Hope into the Indian Ocean, sweeps through the Sunda Straits, and heads into the Pacific toward the equator.
Which is Moby Dick's known feeding ground.
Right. And along this route, Melville uses these structural mile markers called GAMs.
Yeah, a GAM is essentially a mid-ocean meeting between two whaling ships. The captains visit each other's vessels, exchange letters, share news.
But in this narrative, every GAM serves as an escalating warning for Ahab.
Every single ship they meet has some horrific connection to Moby Dick. They meet a ship called the Town Ho, which carries a story of a mutiny where the white whale intervened almost like an agent of divine justice.
Then they meet the Jeroboam, which has a plague on board and a mad prophet named Gabriel, who warns that Moby Dick is the Shaker God incarnate.
But the most striking contrast comes when they meet the Samuel Enderby of London, because the captain of that ship, Captain Boomer, also encountered Moby Dick.
And just like Ahab, Boomer lost a limb to the whale.
His arm, yeah. But Boomer's reaction is entirely different. He has a prosthetic arm made of whalebone, but he's jolly about it.
He tells Ahab that he saw the whale again later, but deliberately chose not to hunt him. He accepts the loss and moves on with his life.
Boomer represents a healthy psychological response to trauma, while Ahab, standing right next to him on his ivory leg, represents the pathological response.
Ahab just demands to know which way the whale was swimming and practically runs back to his own ship. He ignores everything.
Then they hit a typhoon, and the lightning sets the tips of the ship's masts on fire, St. Elmo's fire.
Starbuck begs Ahab to turn around.
But Ahab instead grabs the burning lightning chains and asserts his own dominance over the fire. His paranoia and obsession just reach a fever pitch here.
He even stops trusting his navigational instruments, right?
Yeah, he destroys the ship's quadrant. When the compass needles get inverted by the magnetic storm, he forges his own needles.
He has the blacksmith forge a special harpoon out of the hardest steel, too. And he insists on tempering the red-hot metal not in water, but in the blood of his three pagan harpooners.
And he howls a Latin curse over it, literally baptizing the weapon in the name of the devil.
It is a complete descent into darkness. And finally, they reach the catastrophe. They are in the Pacific, and they encounter a ship called the Rachel.
The captain of the Rachel is absolutely desperate. He tells Ahab they just encountered Moby Dick the day before, and during the chase, a whaleboat carrying the captain's own young son was lost.
So he begs Ahab to lend his ship to help search for the missing boy.
And Ahab's response is chillingly cold. He refuses. He says, "Even now I lose time." He abandons a lost child because he is too close to his prey.
And the very next day, Ahab smells the whale. He climbs the mast himself and spots the white hump. The final, fatal 3-day chase begins.
It's relentless.
I really want to break down the mechanics of those 3 days because it plays out with such terrifying precision. On day one, Ahab lowers his small boat to attack, but Moby Dick does not run.
No, the whale swims directly under Ahab's boat and bites it entirely in half with his jaw.
Ahab is dumped into the ocean and has to be rescued by the main ship.
Then on day two, they catch up and lower the boats again. But Moby Dick uses a different tactic. He violently dashes the small boats together, tangling all their harpoon lines.
And in the chaos, Ahab's personal harpooner gets caught.
Yes, Fadala. He's this mysterious, sinister figure who acts almost like Ahab's shadow. He gets caught in the tangled lines and is dragged down into the depths by the whale.
Which fulfills a really creepy prophecy Fadala made earlier, stating that he would die before Ahab, but Ahab would see him again.
And on day three, that prophecy comes true in a horrific way.
They launch the boats one last time. When Moby Dick breaches the surface, the crew sees Fadala's dead body lashed to the side of the whale by the tangled ropes.
The whale is basically wearing Ahab's crewmen as a warning.
But Ahab still refuses to stop. He darts his harpoon into the whale, and Moby Dick realizes the small boats are just appendages of the larger threat.
So the whale turns his attention to the main ship. He swims at full speed and rams his massive, solid head directly into the starboard bow of the Pequod.
The impact just bursts the solid oak timbers. The ship immediately begins to sink.
Ahab is still in his small boat, watching his ship and his crew go down. He realizes he has doomed them all.
So in a final act of spite, he throws his last harpoon at Moby Dick. The weapon strikes the whale, but the rope connected to the harpoon runs incredibly fast out of its tub, catches Ahab around the neck, and violently yanks him out of the boat.
He is dragged down into the abyss by his own weapon.
The sinking ship creates a massive vortex that sucks down the remaining boats, the masts, and every living crew member.
The ocean simply rolls over them, totally indifferent to the entire struggle. Everyone dies.
If one person.
Ishmael.
Right. He'd been thrown out of a boat on the periphery of the action, and he survives because a life buoy shoots up from the center of the vortex.
And that life buoy happens to be a wooden coffin.
The coffin that Queequeg had carved for himself earlier in the voyage when he fell ill. Ishmael floats on his best friend's coffin for an entire day and night, until he is finally rescued by the Rachel, the very ship Ahab refused to help.
Still out cruising the waters, searching for her lost children. It is a breathtaking, devastating conclusion.
It really is. But because the ending is so relentlessly grim and the philosophical themes are so heavy, there is a massive misconception about this book.
Oh, huge. Modern listeners often assume that the entire narrative is a gloomy, impenetrable, miserable slog from start to finish.
And that couldn't be further from the truth. What surprised me the most going through the source material is how genuinely laugh-out-loud funny the first third of this book is.
It reads like a buddy comedy.
It really does. We talked about Ishmael waking up with Queequeg. Ishmael says Queequeg threw his heavy tattooed arm over him in the most affectionate manner. And Ishmael felt like he had a 100-pound weight pinning him down.
He is screaming in terror. And Queequeg, who doesn't speak much English, just sits up, politely smokes his tomahawk pipe in bed, and looks at Ishmael like he's a lunatic.
The physical comedy is brilliant. And Melville extends that humor to the officers on the ship, too. Consider Stubb, the second mate.
Stubb is great. He's this happy-go-lucky guy who constantly smokes a pipe to ward off the miseries of life.
Right. And after the crew kills their first whale, Stubb demands that the ship's cook, an elderly man named Fleece, prepare him a whale steak.
But Stubb complains the meat is too tough and cooked too much. Then, while he is eating on the deck, hundreds of sharks are in the water below, tearing at the dead whale carcass and making a massive racket.
Stubb gets annoyed by the noise of the sharks eating. So he forces the cook to lean over the side of the ship with a lantern and preach a sermon to the sharks, telling them to chew their food more quietly and share with the smaller sharks.
And the cook is just muttering under his breath, wishing Stubb was a shark himself. It's pure caricature.
You also have Flask, the third mate, who treats these majestic 100-ton leviathans as if they are just magnified mice that need to be exterminated.
But Melville deliberately lulls you into this comfortable, character-driven rhythm so that he can contrast it with the gritty, mechanical reality of the industry.
Right. And this brings us to the most controversial aspect of the book, the cetology chapters.
Ah, yes. We have to talk about cetology.
I will be honest. When I hit these chapters, I was completely thrown. You are in the middle of this high-stakes, suspenseful journey, and suddenly Melville hits the brakes to deliver highly technical textbook-style lectures.
Yeah, he classifies different species of whales like books in a library. He details the skeletal anatomy. He explains the rope systems.
Why would an author sabotage their own narrative pacing like that?
Well, it's actually a deliberate structural choice to ground the myth. If Melville only gave you Ahab's grand speeches and a spooky white whale, the story would just float away into a fairy tale.
Oh, I see.
By forcing the listener to understand the exact punishing physical reality of the labor, the danger becomes undeniably real. Take the Tryworks, for example.
Break the mechanics of that down for me, because it sounds incredibly dangerous.
The Tryworks are massive brick kilns built right on the wooden deck of the ship. Inside these brick furnaces are giant iron pots. When they catch a whale and strip the blubber off it, they have to boil that blubber down into pure oil.
So they light a fire inside the brick kilns on a wooden ship.
Exactly.
That seems like an obvious fire hazard.
It absolutely is. To keep the wooden deck from catching fire, they have to keep a reservoir of water constantly sloshing underneath the brick kilns.
Wow.
And what are they using for fuel to keep the fire burning? They use the crispy leftover scraps of the whale's own blubber.
So the whale is literally fueling its own destruction.
Now imagine this scene at night. The ship is plunging through dark ocean swells. Black smoke is billowing from the tri-works. The deck is slick with grease.
And the crew is running around with pitchforks, silhouetted against the roaring red fire.
It looks like hell itself.
That paints a terrifying picture. And the labor to even get the blubber onto the deck is just as intense. I was trying to visualize the monkey rope chapter.
The monkey rope is a perfect example of Melville explaining a mechanism to highlight a theme. To strip the blubber off a dead whale, someone has to physically climb down onto the carcass as it floats in the water alongside the ship.
While the carcass is bobbing violently in the ocean swell.
Covered in slime and blood, bashing against the wooden hull. On top of that, the water is churning with sharks tearing chunks of meat off the whale.
So whoever goes down there is one slip away from death.
Exactly. And the person who goes down is Queequeg. He stands on the slippery whale with a sharp spade. To keep him from falling into the shark frenzy, he wears a heavy belt.
Attached to a rope.
Yes, the monkey rope. And the other end of that rope goes up to the deck of the ship, where it is tied securely to the belt of Ishmael.
Wait, so they are physically tethered together. If Queequeg slips off the whale, Ishmael is dragged to the rail.
If Queequeg falls, Ishmael has to hold Queequeg's entire body weight, or they both go into the ocean.
That is wild.
Ishmael realizes in that moment that his free will has been revoked. His life is inextricably tied to the mistakes or misfortunes of another human being. It is a brilliant physical mechanism that illustrates the interconnectedness of humanity.
And speaking of humanity, we need to look at who is actually pulling these ropes. Because the crew of the Pequod is not a homogeneous group of New Englanders. The diversity on the ship is staggering for an 1851 novel.
Melville calls them an Anacharsis Cluth's deputation from all the isles of the sea, referring to a historical figure who paraded a diverse group of foreigners before the French Assembly to represent the human race.
The Pequod is basically a microcosm of the global proletariat.
It really is. You look at the officers, Ahab, Starbucks, Stubb, Flask, and they are white Americans. They provide the management.
But the physical muscle, the men doing the incredibly dangerous work of actually harpooning the whales, are from everywhere else.
You have Dagu, a gigantic coal-black African man with golden hoop earrings who moves with a lion-like tread.
You have Tashtego, a Native American warrior from Martha's Vineyard. You have Queequeg from Polynesia.
You have sailors from Asia, from the Azores, from all over the world. Ishmael refers to them as isolados, men who live on separate continents of their own minds, but who are now federated along one keel.
They have no unified culture to push back against Ahab's madness. They are bound together only by the ship's labor.
Federated along one keel. That phrase perfectly sets up how Ahab is able to use them. These aren't just background characters. They are the instruments Ahab uses to wage his philosophical war against the universe.
So let's look at the key scenes and motifs that you listeners should pay close attention to. I want to go back to the quarterdeck scene, where Ahab gives his famous pasteboard mask speech.
This is the ideological core of the narrative. Starbuck tries to bring Ahab back to reality, arguing that the whale is just a dumb brute acting on instinct.
And Ahab erupts. He argues that all visible objects are just masks. To make this concept clearer, I like to think of Ahab's worldview like an escape room or a two-way mirror.
Oh, that's interesting.
He looks at the physical world and assumes it's an elaborate trick. He is convinced that behind the mirror, someone or something is standing there watching him suffer, pulling the strings, and he wants to smash the glass.
That is a perfect analogy. Ahab says he sees in the white whale outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it.
That word is key. Malice.
Ahab refuses to accept that he lost his leg to a random accident of biology. If the universe is just blind random physics, then his suffering has no meaning.
But if there is a malicious intelligence hiding behind the mask of the whale, then Ahab has an enemy.
He can fight back. He demands accountability from the universe. He famously declares that he would strike the sun if it insulted him.
It is the ultimate hubris. But what makes the book so complex is that Melville immediately counters Ahab's perspective. Just a few chapters later, Ishmael gives us a completely different analysis of the whale in a chapter called The Whiteness of the Whale.
And Ishmael isn't scared of malice. He is terrified of the color.
Which feels entirely counterintuitive. Culturally, we are taught that whiteness represents purity, innocence, and goodness.
Doves, bridal veils, the robes of angels.
Exactly. How does Melville turn whiteness into a source of terror?
He flips the cultural association by looking at nature. He points out that whiteness is the color of the polar bear, the white shark, the pallor of death, the blinding white squall at sea.
He argues that whiteness isn't actually a color at all. It is the absence of color.
Yes. It represents the atheistic, meaningless void of nature.
So while Ahab looks at the whale and sees a malicious god pulling strings, Ishmael looks at the whale and sees, well, nothing. A giant blank screen.
An empty universe that doesn't care about human beings at all. Ishmael calls it a dumb blankness, full of meaning, in a wide landscape of snows.
That is infinitely more terrifying than an angry god.
And that concept that the whale is a blank screen onto which people project their own meaning is physically visualized in another crucial chapter, the doubloon.
The gold coin Ahab nailed to the mast. I found this sequence structurally brilliant.
The coin itself is just a piece of metal stamped with some images from Ecuador. A sun, three mountain peaks, a flame, a tower, and a rooster.
It has no inherent philosophical meaning.
None, but Melville has the characters walk up to the mast one by one and look at the coin. And each man reads his own psychology into it.
Ahab looks at the firm tower in the volcano and says, "This coin is me." He sees only his own ego and unyielding will.
Then Starbuck steps up. Starbuck is the pious, slightly depressed Quaker. He looks at the three peaks and sees the Holy Trinity, but he also sees a valley of darkness. He concludes the coin symbolizes a life of righteous duty and sorrow.
Then Stubb approaches. He looks at the zodiac signs framing the coin, consults an almanac, and decides the entire universe is just a grand cosmic joke.
And Flask, the mate who sees whales as giant mice, looks at it and literally calculates its exchange rate. He says it's a gold coin worth $16, and he could buy exactly 960 cigars with it.
It is a masterclass in perspectivism. Reality is subjective. Whatever madness, grief, or greed you hold inside you, you will project onto the blankness of the world.
And that brings us to the tension of fate versus free will. Because if everyone is locked in their own perspective, are they destined to die on this ship, or did they choose this path?
Melville illustrates this in a chapter called The Mapmaker.
It is a very quiet, domestic scene on the deck. Ishmael and Queequeg are weaving a sword mat out of rope to use as a lashing for their boat.
Ishmael is passing the yarn back and forth through the long parallel threads, the warp and the woof.
Meanwhile, Queequeg uses a heavy wooden sword to hit the threads, packing them tightly together.
Ishmael falls into a philosophical trance watching this mechanism. He imagines he is looking at the loom of time. He decides that the straight, fixed threads, the warp, represent necessity or fate.
They are unalterable parameters. You cannot change the fact that you were born or the physics of the world you live in.
But his own hand, weaving the shuttle through those threads, represents free will. He has the freedom to maneuver within the fixed boundaries of his life.
And Queequeg's wooden sword, striking the mat randomly, sometimes hitting hard, sometimes glancing off, represents chance.
Fake, free will, and chance, all working together to weave the fabric of reality. Ahab's obsessive drive is fate. Ishmael's decision to sign the papers in Nantucket was free will.
And the sudden appearance of a typhoon or a giant squid is chance. It is a stunning metaphor.
It really is. But, you know, reading these dense philosophical chapters where paragraphs stretch on for pages detailing rope weaving or whale anatomy, it can be challenging on the printed page.
Your eyes can glaze over.
And this is exactly why the audiobook experience completely transforms this text. I noticed that immediately. This book feels like it was written to be spoken out loud.
There is a profound theatricality to Melville's prose. He was heavily influenced by reading Shakespeare's tragedies like King Lear and Hamlet right before writing this.
He wanted to elevate the American novel to that dramatic scale. Some chapters actually include stage directions like "Enter Ahab," to him, Stubb.
Right. When you read Ahab's monologue silently, the archaic language, the thous and arts can feel a bit stiff.
But when you hear a skilled narrator deliver Ahab's sunset soliloquy out loud, you suddenly hear the dark, magnetic poetry. You understand exactly why the crew is mesmerized by him. It is a performance.
The soundscape of the prose is also vital. Melville layered auditory details into the text that come alive in audio.
The rhythmic creaking of the ship's timbers, the sudden terrifying shout from the masthead cutting through the quiet narration. There she blows.
The chaotic, rhythmic sea shanties the crew sings while hauling the massive sheets of blubber. The prose mimics the physical swell of the ocean.
An audiobook also helps you track the wild emotional mood swings of the narrator. Ishmael's tone is never static.
No, it shifts constantly.
He goes from the conversational, lighthearted buddy comedy tone at the spouter end to a dry, encyclopedic tone during the biology lectures, and then ramps up into an apocalyptic, prophetic voice during the final chase.
Hearing those shifts guides your ear through the emotional terrain. And hearing that apocalyptic voice aloud forces us to confront the modern resonance of the book.
Because this is not just a museum piece about 19th century fishing.
The warnings Melville embedded in this text feel incredibly urgent today. Let's look at the anatomy of a demagogue. Ahab's leadership style is a timeless playbook for authoritarianism.
Think about the charismatic, narcissistic leaders or figures you see dominating the news cycle today. Ahab uses the exact same tactics to manipulate a crowd. He doesn't just ask them to do a job. He manufactures a shared frenzy.
And he does it in very calculated steps. Step one is appealing to their immediate greed. He nails the gold doubloon to the mast and promises physical wealth to anyone who finds the whale.
He buys their initial attention.
But he knows cash alone won't sustain a multi-year suicide mission.
Step two is the ritual. He forces the crew into a demonic communion. He has the harpooners cross their lances, he fills the metal sockets with liquor, and makes them drink a violent oath together.
He creates an us-versus-the-world mentality, overriding their individual rationality with the collective energy of the mob.
And step three is neutralizing the opposition. He physically and intellectually overpowers Starbuck, the only man capable of stopping him.
Ahab recognizes that this diverse crew of isolados lacks a unified culture, so he molds them into an extension of his own will.
He states that his one-cogged circle fits into all their various wheels, making them revolve. He gleefully sacrifices the entire ship and everyone on it just to strike back at a personal grievance.
It is a chilling portrait of how easily a society can be dragged into self-destruction by a leader obsessed with his own wounds.
But there is another massive modern resonance here, the conflict between humanity and nature. Melville dedicates chapter 105 to a question that feels incredibly prescient. Does the whale's magnitude diminish? Will he perish?
He is asking if the whale will go extinct from overhunting. He explicitly compares the mechanization of whaling to the slaughter of the American buffalo on the plains.
He sees the industrial scale of the extraction. But I want to challenge Melville's conclusion in that chapter.
Go for it.
Because his ultimate answer is no, the whale won't go extinct. He argues that the ocean is too vast. The whales have polar fortresses where ice prevents ships from entering, and the whale is effectively immortal.
Right.
But reading that today, knowing what happened in the 20th century with mechanized factory ships that nearly wiped out multiple species, and knowing that climate change is melting those very polar fortresses, I mean, it changes the entire meaning of the text.
It creates a profound tragic irony. Melville believed that the ocean was an invincible, eternal force that would always humble humanity. He writes that the sea will forever insult and murder man. He thought nature would always win.
But we know now that human industry, represented by the Pequod's relentless fire-burning tryworks, is actually the existential threat.
Precisely. Ahab thought he was fighting an invincible god. But the reality is that the Pequod was the vanguard of a capitalist system that would eventually strip the oceans bare.
The true horror isn't just that the ship sank. It is that the mindset of the Pequod, the relentless extraction of resources at all costs, survived.
We are still on that ship. We are still boiling down the natural world to keep our artificial lights burning, even as the environmental storm gathers around us.
It is the great American epic because it holds a mirror up to the fundamental flaws in our relationship with power and with the planet.
We have covered immense ground today. Moby Dick is not simply a revenge story. It is a visually stunning, darkly humorous, and structurally brilliant exploration of human obsession, the indifference of the natural world, and the fragile monkey ropes that tether us to one another.
It is a text that demands to be experienced in its full chaotic rhythm. You have to let the language wash over you. Don't skip the cetology chapters. Let the gritty details of the boiling oil and the massive ropes ground you before the cosmic terror hits.
And that is why we invite you to experience the full power of this epic by returning to the Clara Horatio audiobook. Let the narration pull you into the world of the Pequod.
As you return to the text, I want to leave you with one final thought to consider. It stems from a chapter late in the book concerning whaling law, called Fast Fish and Loose Fish.
Explain the legal code there.
Well, in the whaling industry, a fast fish is a whale that is physically attached to a ship by a harpoon line. It legally belongs to the party that struck it.
A loose fish is a whale swimming free, making it fair game for anyone strong enough to capture it.
Melville takes this pragmatic legal code and expands it to encompass the entire globe. He asks, what was America in 1492 but a loose fish? What is India to England? What are the rights of man or people's minds and opinions but loose fish for the taking?
He is suggesting that under the system, everything in the world, land, ideas, human beings, is treated as property to be violently claimed by whoever throws the strongest harpoon.
So the question you must ask yourself is this. In a world where every belief, every resource, and every idea is treated as a loose fish to be captured and exploited, are you the one throwing the harpoon? Or are you simply a member of the crew rowing blindly towards someone else's destruction?
Are you driving the ship, or are you just hoping the storm passes?
We are all on that space station floating in the void, waiting to see if the captain knows where he is going. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Go listen to The Whale.